we would be the ones that would have to tell patients that they had to leave. And I would have all these patients begging me to not kick them out of the hospital. And we would have to. We would like escort them to the elevator and basically kick them out. And then 2 or 3 days later, they would come back.
Hello and welcome to Clinical Changemakers, the podcast that explores vital lessons in healthcare leadership, innovation, and so much more. I'm your host, Dr. Jono. Today on the show, we have Dr. Margot Kershaw. Dr. Kershaw is a practicing medical doctor and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Amongst other duties, she is the director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. Her research focuses on the causes and consequences of homelessness and housing instability. Dr. Margot Kershaw, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm really excited to talk to you today about the research that you've authored in how people have been experiencing homelessness in California, a statewide study which goes through the who, the what, the how, and also importantly highlights a number of key policies that could improve that issue. But before we jump into that, I'd love to know a little bit more about your background, where you grew up, and perhaps your journey into healthcare.
Yeah. So I grew up on the other side of the country in New York, right outside New York City, right north of the Bronx. And I sort of always knew that I wanted to be a physician, but took some circuitous routes there. I majored in English literature in college, in part because I knew that I was going to be spending a lot of time doing sciences. And I famously told my first year advisor, who did politics, that I hated politics and was uninterested in it, which actually is very funny now since that's mostly what I do. But in college, I got very involved in our public policy school. So I was that nerdy person who would go to all the talks about healthcare reform in the US, which was a big topic in the 80s. And spent a lot of time there. I also spent a lot of time working with people experiencing homelessness. It was the 80s, and it was sort of the first era of this modern era of homelessness where we all thought it was an emergency that was going to go away quickly, or we hoped that. After college, I wound up working for my first year advisor, who was elected to office in Seattle, and worked as a policy aide for him, did some work for the health department, went back to medical school. And if you would have asked my medical school self what I wanted to do, I was very interested in healthcare for the working poor. I used to say that the, 20-year-old me would be very excited about Obamacare, knowing that we were never going to get to a UK system or New Zealand system of healthcare, that it was the best we were going to get for now. But then I started to practice out here in San Francisco. I did a residency program that was specifically focused on the problems of urban underserved populations, and about half of the people we cared for were experiencing homelessness. And so in typical sort of US way of doing it, we would admit them to the hospital and we would provide all sorts of very high tech, very sophisticated healthcare. It was very expensive and very fancy. And then we would literally discharge them to the streets. And as a house staff, as a resident physician, which is what you do after medical school here in the US, we would be the ones that would have to tell patients that they had to leave. And I would have all these patients begging me to not kick them out of the hospital. And we would have to. We would like escort them to the elevator and basically kick them out. And then 2 or 3 days later, they would come back sicker than when they left. I think now the words I would use for that was moral injury. I'm not sure at the time I had that language, but I was really devastated by it. I thought, this doesn't make any sense. And I switched what I was going to do from focusing on expanding insurance access to focusing on the needs of people experiencing homelessness. And I can tell you that in the mid-1990s, when I announced that that's what I was going to do, a lot of people told me, he's throwing away my career. There's no National Institutes of Homelessness. No one's ever going to be interested in this or fund this work or care about this work. But that's what I decided to do, because I did the thing that kept me up at night. The thing that was most outrageous to me, I decided that I couldn't just leave it be.
I think that illustrates a lot of bravery. I mean, How did this position percolate into a final decision when you were going to make that shift?
So I had a very unusual circumstance, which is that since I was a small child, I had a pretty serious health condition. You have to sort of go back to the 1980s when I was in college, where I was very ill. And it was before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. And so there was no protection for someone with disabilities, chronic illness. My college told me that no medical school would ever accept me, because they would never take someone as sick as I was. And they actually refused to send out the letters. Like in the US, you go to university, you got college first, then from college, you apply to medical school. And the college has to send out all these letters sort of recommending you. And they basically refused to send anything out. And there was no legal recourse or anything. And I think it was, I think there was a point in me that was just so angry that I somehow just really wanted to be a doctor. It doesn't really make sense because it was really not a very sensible career considering my health, but I was really intent on it. And as horrible as those years of residency were, when we were working, you know, 100 hours a week and would stay up for, you know, all night, every third night, and never, you know, would have 2 days off a month, and I was sick as a dog, and as I was using a wheelchair, and sort of as horrible as it was, there was a part that made me feel I had nothing to lose. Like I, you know, that at any point I could have walked away and it would have been the sensible thing to do. Like everyone was like, why are you doing this to yourself? You should walk away. And so I had a lot of decision points where I had to actively choose to do it. And I think when I got through the training, I thought that I always wanted to sort of honor that I had fought so hard for this, that I really wanted to make it worth it. And so I think it gave me a little bit of almost weird confidence where I was like, well, if I could do that, I could do anything. And I love being a practicing physician and I'm a primary care physician, and there's always a need for primary care physicians in the US. We have a huge shortage. So I think I kind of knew that I would always have a job, you know, that if the research didn't work out or the policy didn't work out, my default was something I loved doing, which was seeing patients, and that I knew that I would always be fully employed. Like I just, it's sort of a beautiful thing being a primary care physician. Like, you know, that you can always get a job doing that. And I love doing that. It wasn't like a bad thing to do. And so I think I just decided that I was just going to go for it. And if it didn't work, then my default was something I was also very excited to do.
That's a fascinating story. And I think what it makes me reflect on a little bit is, as clinicians, thinking about what the benefits and privileges we kind of have with our career kind of allow for a lot more risk-taking than I think we realize. Yeah. I think often we can be almost institutionalized within our training to be that, you know, you must become a surgeon, therefore you must do these tests, and this is the only route you can take. But actually, there is a lot more risk that you can take. And within healthcare, so much opportunity to make a difference. And I think your story is a really, really powerful one. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, I think we leave some of our power on the table. We don't recognize how incredibly privileged we are. Like, we have a job that, while it may not get paid like the tech workers get paid, you know, we get really well paid and we'll always be able to support our families. Will always have work, and that work is incredibly meaningful work. Like, you know, it's like I knew that once I made it through training, I was always going to have incredibly meaningful work, that I was always going to be able to pay my bills, that I was always going to do something that had meaning. And weirdly, that gave me the courage to take bigger risks, because it wasn't like I dreaded being a primary care physician. In fact, one of the biggest problems with my work is that I don't get to do primary care enough. You know, it has taken over so much of my life that I am way down in practicing now, and I only see patients a half a day a week. And that is actually a sacrifice. But I realized that if it didn't work, great, I would just get a job in a safety net healthcare system, which was work that I was incredibly privileged to do and that I love doing.
One thing you mentioned a little bit earlier on around this concept of moral injury, and I think that is something that is becoming language to describe many clinicians, but also people in other jobs, in other industries, in other places where they are having to do things that go against their values because of the way that systems and incentives are set up. I wondered if you could comment on the experience of that moral injury when you reflect on that, and perhaps whether or not you think that those sorts of situations are still happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that moral injury in some ways is the downside. You know, for all the privilege we have of physicians, we don't have the privilege of ignoring that inequality and ignoring the horror and people suffering. And we're often put in positions where we're asked to just sort of move past it. And I think that's where the moral injury comes in. You know, when you see so much suffering and the range of things that you're allowed to do are really narrow, when you see how nonsensical the system is, you know, particularly in a place like the US where we have not just a two-tiered system of care, like we have like a four-tiered system of care, right? We still in many states have people with no insurance whatsoever. In a state like California, that's a little less true. Most people, although not everyone, qualifies for insurance, but that insurance gets you very different things. Like what I can get as a patient, because I'm so privileged, is so different than what I can offer my patients. But we also have this front row seat to suffering. And there's, you know, the suffering that is sort of coming from, you know, above, like that we can't explain why a young mother gets cancer or something, that brings about a lot of grief. But the moral injury, I think, comes from the inequities and from our inability to intervene on those inequities and yet be handed the consequences of them and have to sit in a room with someone where we know that we can't offer them what we could offer somebody else or what our own families would get offered, where we know that we could spend $10,000 on healthcare, but could never spend $5,000 on rent, which would make a much bigger difference in someone's life, where we hear people's experiences of racism and what they've suffered, and we have to bear witness to it, but don't always feel like we can intervene. And where we, you know, I think as physicians, again, speaking from the US context, we make a lot of money, right? Like we are very privileged economically. And yet if you work particularly in safety net healthcare, none of your patients are, there's just so many problems. And I think that what a lot of people call burnout, I don't think it's actually the workload. Physicians that I know are happy to work hard, like they love their work, and it's hard because, again, like in the US, there's no childcare and there's like all these problems. But basically, I think the real source of what we call burnout is actually just uncontrolled moral injury that just wears you down.
Yeah, I'm nodding to that because I completely agree. And I think also, in some sense, the hardening of some clinicians' approach to healthcare, perhaps as a defensive mechanism from being injured for so long that that the experience has been such that you want to shut it out, and so maybe you move away from it, or you practice in a way that tries to shelter you from consistently being inflicted by those types of scenarios.
And it's understandable, right? I mean, I do think what the public sees and views as like a lack of caring is just a defense mechanism.
Yeah. Now, I'd love for us to pivot to the incredible work that you've recently been doing and around the California statewide study of people experiencing homelessness. Now, the first thing I wanted to comment was a quote that I really, really liked as kind of framing this conversation, which was, "Homelessness is an experience that people have, not a statement of who they are." And I think that needs to be repeated around this topic all of the time. One thing before we jump into kind of the current situation and where we go to from here is around some definitions of what homelessness means versus, say, unhoused and unsheltered.
Yeah, I think, you know, homelessness has this very technical definition in the US of meeting certain criteria, not having a regular place to stay, and something like an emergency homeless shelter counts as that. Having, you know, having to flee a place and not having any place to stay, being discharged from an institution, not having a place to go. So that's the very technical definition. It includes people who staying in places like emergency homeless shelters, which are often these big group, you know, warehouse-like settings, but sometimes there are these tiny homes, these little cabins that people live in or whatever. But it also includes people living in their vehicles, which is increasingly common, or people living outside. In California, about 2/3 of everyone, about 3/4 of adults are living what's called unsheltered. So unsheltered includes people living in their cars. Living in like RVs counts as unsheltered if you're not hooked up and you don't have tenancy rights, or living outside. But people living in group homeless shelters or in those tiny home cabins are also homeless. I think that the public conflates those things and thinks of shelter as housing, but people in shelters, if you don't have tenancy rights, if you don't have any, you know, legal rights to where you're staying, that's, and it's like a place for people experiencing homelessness, you are still homeless if you're there. And part of the really disturbing, there's lots of disturbing conversations in California, one, but one is the really conflation of those two things. And we see, for instance, that basically everyone who's experiencing homelessness would choose stable housing, but a large portion of people would rather not be shelter settings because they're so demeaning and often dangerous and things. And so the solutions are often like people will conflate those and say they didn't accept shelter and therefore they don't want to be housed. I'm like, well, you cannot accept shelter and jump at the chance of housing. And in fact, that's very common.
Yeah, I appreciate going through those definitions. I mean, in preparation for this, I was looking at some global statistics on homelessness, looking at New Zealand and Australia and the UK and others. And one thing was around how the different definitions can change the size of the issue. But what it highlighted to me was actually the issue is everywhere, and it's bigger than it should be everywhere.
Yeah.
So even when you try to drill down on those differences, you still have a significant proportion of human beings experiencing homelessness. And I think one thing I reflect on is to think about, you know, where would I want my mum to be living? And so the sheltered and unhoused and homeless, all of those technical definitions, I'm sure very valuable for research. I think if you just took it to a really basic level and thought about your own family member or loved one, would they be happy and thriving in one of these sorts of places? If the answer is no, then that is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Right.
Now, sometimes we talk about this as how it impacts or costs society. And I wondered if you could comment on that framing of how we kind of understand that the size of this impact.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the people who are most impacted obviously are those experiencing homelessness, and the impacts for them are just incalculably horrible. But it impacts everybody. Like in San Francisco right now, there's a lot of distress around the homelessness that is really from the gaze of people who are housed. So a lot of the framing is around people who are housed. And that's sometimes where you get to that idea of we should just put everyone in shelter, because that solves the problem in a lot of ways, out of sight, out of mind for people who are housed. But there are huge costs to society. There's the intangibles, like loss, you know, costs the business community to tourism. There's the moral injury. You know, what do we say to our children about what does it mean to grow up in a place where so many people are so visibly suffering? There are the costs or things, the amount that society spends on things like public works, you know, cleaning places, sweeping, which is a terrible term, but sort of forced displacements, where we spend a lot of our dollars moving people from one place to another. We spend a lot of money in policing, not so much because there's danger, but because we criminalize the experience of homelessness. Shelter beds cost between $100 and $300 a night. You know, you could buy a lot of housing. You could pay a lot of rent for those costs. And then there's the cost of like excess. You know, we found that 30% of people experiencing homelessness had a short jail stay. during their time homeless. Now, you have to believe that if someone were really a threat to the community, right, the response to that is not to put them in jail for 5 days. Like, that doesn't resolve any threat. So that's just this institutional cycling and just outrageous amounts of sort of expensive and I would argue expensive and not really helpful medical care, like to cycle in and out of an emergency department. You know, people debate the real cost of that because emergency department is open anyway, you know, whatever, but it's costly, hospitalizations, but it's also, we can spend money on healthcare if it's going to improve people's health, but having people cycle in and out of institutional settings or acute care settings isn't really the type of healthcare that you and I as primary care physicians like think of as the type of healthcare spend that actually improves outcomes.
Yeah, I'm really glad you talked about the expense, because I think a way to understand this is we are all paying for this in some way,
yes,
whether or not we like it or not. So our tax dollars, how we fund local community projects, you know, all of these sorts of things, we are paying for it in one way or another. So wouldn't we just rather the most effective, efficient, yeah, sustainable, long-term type of investment as opposed to some of these point solutions, right, that, as you say, can be out of sight, out of mind, but never really get to the crux of solving an issue for a bunch of human beings who are, you know, brothers, sisters, mums, dads, you know, all of the people in our society that we should be valuing.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there is this dialogue now. I talk to journalists a lot, and every other question I get is like, we're spending so much money, but we're not getting anywhere. And first of all, we are, the way people calculate how we're spending money is a little funny, like, but the other thing is, it is expensive to manage a crisis, right? It is expensive to manage a crisis, and we can't seem to extricate ourselves in doing the hard work. And don't get me wrong, it's going to be hard work. Like, California right now has 24 units of housing that are available and affordable for every 100 extremely low-income households. So we're 1 million units short of housing in our state that very poor people can afford. And so in some ways, the 170-ish thousand people who experience homelessness nightly in our state are really the tip of the iceberg. It's really 1 million households that are at extraordinarily high risk of homelessness that are doubled and tripled and quadrupled up in really unsafe, unthriving housing. And so what we're doing is we're seeing the tip of the iceberg, and we're spending all of this money in a very ineffective way. It is not going to be easy to get to the real roots of this, but we're not going to get there by having this really harmful, often racist, often dehumanizing dialogue. Like, one of the things we found in the study, which wasn't a surprise, but was really clear, which is that 9 out of 10 people lost their stable housing in California. Higher percentage of people were born in California than Californians overall. It sort of makes sense, right? When you're desperately poor and you lose your housing, you're not going to pick up and spend money that you don't have to move across the country to the most expensive housing market in the country away from your families and friends and community. Like, it just doesn't even make sense. But this is a very common idea throughout the U.S. Wherever I go in the U.S., everyone is convinced that people experiencing homelessness are coming from outside. I think we need to be very, very worried about that thought, because it's really a way to dehumanize people. It's like an old trope, right? Of a way, the first way we dehumanize people is to say they're not like us, they aren't us, they're invaders. You know, the language is very much like similar in some ways to the language of immigrants or refugees. I think it sets the stage for some really terrible behavior.
And I would add to that is they're all Americans, right? So even if it were the case that, right, people are moving,
right,
the state borders are a collection of states which all, you know, have the same national, right, anthem and same constitution. So
right, exactly. It's not like when you go from Nevada into California, you just drive by, you know, it is like this ridiculous idea. You know, I think you could argue it's an important conversation if the alternative were true, that states tend to have different policy environments. And so if it was like, oh, wow, because we have great, you know, supportive policies, it's drawing people, and then you need to even out the policy environment. But exactly right. They're all Americans, right? And so, and God forbid they weren't Americans, but like they literally are all Americans. Our borders are, there are no borders in, for the non-US, your non-US audience, like there are no borders between our states. You just drive by, it means you have a, it's like driving between cities, really. It's just the same thing. Yeah.
And I think what we've touched on here is a couple of facets, which I'd love to go a little bit deeper on around kind of structural factors, individual factors,
yeah,
and the social safety net that,
yeah,
can be the drivers for people becoming homeless. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk to that.
Yeah, I think the three main mental models that I have of sort of what causes homelessness. The first was laid out in a book, you know, many years ago, by Lauden Aaron and Martha Burt, where they talked about homelessness as arising as an interaction between structural factors. So things like the amount of affordable housing, income inequality, between structural factors, individual factors, things that might increase someone's personal risk, having a substance use or a mental health disability, let's say, and then the presence or absence of a safety net, whether you have things like unemployment insurance or rental assistance and things. And their point was the less forgiving the structural environment is and the safety net, the fewer individual risk factors you need to become homeless. So when I've traveled to Northern Europe, you know, to Scandinavia, let's say, which has a much more robust safety net, but also much more flat economy, much more housing affordability and social housing and things, you still do see some people who are experiencing homelessness, but it tends to be people with a very significant individual deficit, people who are really struggling personally. Whereas in the US, those folks are homeless, but so are a lot of folks who don't have those individual vulnerabilities just because our structures are so poor and our safety net is so weak. So that's one model. The two other ones that I like to think about is one from this fabulous book called In the Midst of Plenty by Mary Beth Shin and Jill Kadoury, which notes that there are really two different questions. Why is there so much homelessness in a region? And why is this person homeless? And if you ask those questions, they lend themselves to very different answers. Why is there so much homelessness in California compared to in Ohio? It's because of our housing costs, actually. It's like there's a linear relationship between housing costs and amounts of homelessness in a region. If you ask the question, why is this person homeless? A person's individual risk factors, their vulnerabilities really set the stage for them to be more or less likely to be homeless. But the problem is that we often answer the former with the answer to the latter. So people make up these stories that aren't true. Like California actually has relatively low rates of substance use and mental health problems compared to other states in the US, but we have the highest housing costs and therefore we have some of the highest homelessness rates. And then the third is this wonderful book, Homelessness as a Housing Problem by Greg Colburn and Clayton Aldern. And they interviewed me for the book, and I use this analogy. They later told me that many people use this analogy, and they wrote it up really well, which is this musical chairs analogy, common game played, you know, at a birthday party, 10 kids, 10 chairs, you play music, the kids walk around, adult puts away a chair, and the kids scramble for the remaining chairs. And they basically do this thought experiment of like, well, what if one kid showed up with a broken ankle, and they were on crutches, and they weren't walking well? If you had to ask the question, you know, who's going to be standing? Most likely that kid. But if you ask the question, why is someone standing? Well, someone's standing because you only have 9 chairs. So either two people are sitting on top of each other or someone is standing. And likewise, if you hadn't pulled away a chair, that kid with on crutches eventually would have found their way to sitting. And if you didn't have a kid on crutches, but you only had 9 chairs, someone would be standing because you only have 9 chairs. And so that to me is like the difference between those structural conditions and the individual vulnerabilities. And the reason we have so much homelessness in California is we don't have enough, as it were, chairs. We don't have enough housing for people experiencing homelessness. But it's not a surprise that in a really brutal housing market, the people who are more likely to lose out are people with pre-existing vulnerabilities.
I really like that analogy. And I think the other comment that connects to this is if you're just looking at the data and you're seeing a linear relationship between extremely low incomes and housing availability, you know, that is the graph that is telling a lot of the story here. But you're right, there is often quite a big conversation about drugs, about mental health and how perhaps those pre-existing or existing experiences over somebody's lifetime could be drivers for homelessness. But I guess what you're saying is that connection is not as clear, but also even if there was some more of a relationship there, perhaps we would still have obligations to treat somebody who needs some help.
Absolutely. I mean, most people who use substances, most people with mental health disabilities are housed. And empirically, we've shown that it's very easy to house successfully people with those disabilities. You just need the right array of services available to them. But, you know, that is not why there's so much homelessness. So first of all, we always have an obligation for people with disabilities to serve them. We know how to serve them. These are highly stigmatized disabilities, but that's just a societal decision. Like they just, you know, I'm not personally afraid of mental health problems or substance use problems. It's kind of part of the human condition. It's often a response to trauma, et cetera, but it almost doesn't matter, right? We're not in medieval times where we think people are possessed by the devil, but sometimes we act that way, you know? But that is a very different problem than a homelessness. Homelessness is quite literally the lack of a home. And when you look at places with high rates of homelessness or low rates of homelessness, you can explain it by the availability of housing for very low income households.
At the risk of, in some sense, over-medicalizing something, I often was thinking about how we think of metabolic syndrome as a collection, a constellation of conditions, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugars that increase somebody's risk of a heart attack and stroke. Right. And clinicians very much accept that and have a professional obligation to be talking about it, to be treating it, to go to conferences, to learn more about it. And homelessness, you know, when you break apart its clinical impacts of mental health, substance misuse, chronic health conditions, infections, nutrition, social isolation, you know, it's almost like a reframing to homelessness impact syndrome or something that kind of helps us to reframe and understand that a person is experiencing this series of conditions, and we have actually quite a lot of tools to intervene, and particularly at the policy level. I think as well, if you look at a statin or a medicine to lower cholesterol in somebody at risk of having a heart condition, we would look at things like number needed to treat. So how many people do you need for this medicine to have its impact? And we would be comfortable with a number needed to treat of 20 or 10. And the number needed to treat for homelessness is one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one home for that one person. And so we would be jumping for joy if we had a drug that prevented someone from having a heart attack that was that powerful. I wonder what you think about that, Frank.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, in the US right now, so there's a very evidence-based way to house people experiencing homelessness. It has been around for a long time. It's been tested empirically in the US and Canada and France and other places. It's called Housing First. And it's this idea that when people are struggling, when they are homeless, all of their mental energy, like someone in our study said, being homeless is a full-time job. Like all of their mental energy is on their safety, their security, finding a place. They really don't have the headspace to engage in addressing any other problem. And so the idea of Housing First, it used to be in the US that in order to, you had to sort of earn your right to housing. Like you would go into a shelter, and if you didn't use substances, you know, then maybe you'd be offered a temporary housing situation. And if you didn't use substances, maybe you'd be offered a permanent housing situation. And the problem with that is, you know, about 5% of people that worked for, and everyone else relapsed and was back out on the street. And so when it's been tested against this Housing First idea, where you offer people housing, you offer services like substance use treatment, mental health treatment, but you don't require it. Because the idea is if you require it, that becomes a barrier. And basically people have to take it before they might be ready to, when they're pre-contemplative or early contemplative, right? If you offer them housing and then you make those services very available, what has just been shown empirically is that people stay housed. And they take up those services because it turns out, you know, over time, people's lives stabilize and they are in the headspace to address those. There's been a really full blown political, well-funded attack on Housing First. Because remember, who is over experiencing homelessness in the U.S.? People of color, people with these stigmatized health conditions, often people of color who have these stigmatized health conditions, right? It's really like picking on people and blaming them and moving back to a war on drugs or a criminalization of behavior that we see as health-related or medical. And it's not at all evidence-based. But the empirical evidence that that side uses is, well, we've been doing Housing First, but homelessness is getting worse. Well, homelessness is getting worse because housing costs have risen and we haven't built housing, right? That's why homelessness is getting worse. We know that. And we know that if we offer those services, we do. And so I like to say, you know, we know that statins, let's say, prevent heart attacks in people at risk. If you couldn't push out the statins, if people weren't taking the statins because there weren't enough statins to give out, right? Or they were too expensive or the docs forgot to prescribe it and people still had heart attacks, we wouldn't say statins don't work because in fact, we know statins work. What we would say is, oh, we need to lower the cost of statins. We need to lower the barrier to people getting statins. We need to get people statins. But what's happened in the homelessness vector is we haven't offered the housing. People are homeless because housing costs have gone up or whatever. And they, because of political reasons, don't like Housing First because they see it as rewarding, quote unquote, bad behavior. They're using that as, quote unquote, proof that Housing First doesn't work. It actually doesn't make any sense when you break it down like that. It's the equivalent of saying statins don't prevent heart attacks for a group of people who were not offering statins.
Reflecting on what you've said, thinking about how clinicians have such an important role, not only in the front line in caring for people, but also our role within institutions and then in broader society. And I think at times that third piece, our role in broader society, isn't always emphasized to us, and we sometimes don't know how to direct some of that potential energy. I wondered, what would you say to clinicians who really want to engage with this idea to get behind the policies that you're suggesting or take some sort of action? What would you encourage clinicians to do?
So clinicians have a lot of trust in society. People trust them. They have a voice and they leave that voice on the table. And so it is starting to speak up to using your experiences as a physician or as a clinician, you know, to storytelling. And I would say start small. Like, I work with a ton of homelessness and housing advocacy organizations who would love nothing more than to have physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners and the like be on their side, be available to give 2 minutes of testimony at government, you know, events, be willing to write letters to the editor, be willing to show up in a white coat. Like, I never wear a white coat except at things like this. I never wear white coat to actually see patients, but I sometimes wear it for things like this because it signals to the public that I'm a physician, to show up and speak as a physician, to use the stories. Obviously, we can't tell direct patient stories because that would violate their private, but you can sort of privacy, but you can kind of just abstract stories, you know, use examples, write letters to the editors, speak out, offer to speak out at in the spaces that you're in, whether that's in PTA meetings or churches or, you know, or whatever. You know, don't feel like you need to go it on your own. There are these advocacy organizations for this issue or any other issue that you care about. Trust me, those organizations would love nothing more than getting a phone call or an email from someone saying, my name is so-and-so, I am a nurse practitioner, I'm a physician, I'm whatever. This issue really outrages me. How can I help? They will direct you to how to help, but they need your voice. I would say, don't let these stories go unanswered. You know, when you hear people dehumanizing people experiencing homelessness say, I'm a nurse, substance use doesn't scare me. I know how to help people who have substance use problems. I'm a physician. Mental health problems don't scare me. They are just part of the human condition. They are an illness. They are a you know, disease script, and we know how to help people. But what I can't do is help people when they're on the street getting assaulted, getting arrested. I promise you, like, that's how I started. I just started cold calling organizations. it turns out every church wants someone to give a talk. You know, they have like adult education. Like there were just like a million opportunities to get involved. But what I see is we don't know how to do it. Stand up in your community and use your voice. Like in the US, a big issue is we can't get anything zoned. No one wants to have low income housing next door to them. The people who are in opposition show up at those meetings. They're generally wealthy white homeowners who've got nothing but time on their hands. And the people who are like, I would love to have a diverse neighborhood. I would love to raise my children with diversity. And most importantly, I would love that children who are in school with my kids to not be homeless, you know, be the person who shows up and says that at that meeting. I'm a homeowner. I'm a renter. I live in this neighborhood. I fully support this housing being built. Talk to your elected officials, write to your elected officials, you know, let your voices be heard because they hear from the people who don't want these things.
I think often clinicians, we defer to expertise quite a lot. You know, we're used to referring to a cardiologist or a neurosurgeon or whatever. And so sometimes wading into issues without being the perfect expert can hold us back. But I think what you're saying is that, first of all, you don't need to be an expert.
Yeah. Yeah.
Number one. Number two, showing up is the first step. And part of that showing up is listening. And so even if that first time you turn up, you don't say anything, you now know the state of things. Who else is showing up? Who else is speaking? What are they saying? What does it mean? And where have they come from? And what is their area of expertise? And I think what you're encouraging there is there are a lot of avenues for clinicians to explore to be to upskill in this area and to make a big impact.
Absolutely. I think we hold ourselves back. And, you know, there is a book, really horrible book, making the rounds that's written by someone with no expertise. He cites hundreds and hundreds of things, none of which say what he says. They say, I didn't realize books don't need to be, they're not fact checked. So he has all these citations, but literally a citation says the sky is blue and he writes the sky is red citation. And he had no trouble declaring himself an expert, and he's viewed as an expert because he has announced he's an expert. I think that we need to get out of that feeling that we need to know everything to speak at all. And we need to listen, right? That we aren't experts in everything. And so we can read, we can learn, we can listen to others, we can partner. One of my favorite community activists reminds everyone at every meeting to step up and step back. And she says, like, if you notice yourself holding yourself back from an idea or something, step up and say it, but also step back and listen to other people with other forms of expertise. I think that it's good to not make all sorts of claims we don't know anything about, but we know a lot more than we think we know. And we also have the capacity to learn. We can read books, we can read articles, we can go and listen to others, we can listen and learn and say, this is what I know. I feel really confident speaking about this or this or this. I feel really confident speaking about how terrible not having housing is for health. Let me talk about that. And you don't have to talk about building codes or whatever, because that's not your expertise. Someone else can do that.
All right, Dr. Margot Kershaw, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you so much for the work that you've been doing and the recent piece of research. I really think it's powerful, and I think everybody should have a read. So thanks so much, Margot.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of the podcast. If you want to go deeper about any of these topics or join the discussion, visit our website, clinicalchangemakers.com. Now, one small ask. This is a brand new podcast, so if you enjoyed our work, please rate us and share it with your friends and colleagues. Until next time, take care.